Hello, thank you for listening to Salvation Stuff. I am glad and honored that you are listening today. This is an extremely important episode today. In our last study, we left off considering who Jesus really was. C.S. Lewis proposed that Jesus was either a lunatic, a liar, or the Lord that he claimed to be. But to make that decision, one must know what Jesus said and did and who he ultimately claimed to be. And more important than knowing these critically important questions is whether Jesus provides any evidence to support his claims of divinity. The virgin birth of Jesus, the miracles he performed, his teachings, and indeed his whole life point to and culminate in one monumentally historic act. That is his death on the cross and his resurrection from the tomb. For this reason, we'll focus our attention on the resurrection of Jesus based on three crucial truths. This is Evidence and Reason of the Resurrection. Episode 3 of Foundational Faith starts now.
Engaging, encouraging, and enlightening.
So the resurrection of Jesus just cannot be overstated. People in the Corinthian church were starting to say that the resurrection wasn't even possible. And the Apostle Paul addresses this in his letter in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. He says, hey, listen, if Christ is not risen, then our preaching is empty and your faith is also empty. Yes, we are found to be false witnesses of God because we have testified of God that he has raised up Christ, whom he did not raise up, if in fact the dead do not rise. For if the dead do not rise, then Christ is not risen. And if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. That's the way Paul said it. We have no hope if Christ has not risen from the dead. We're made to be false witnesses of God. Our faith is empty. Our prayers are empty. And most importantly, we would still be in our sins. So to say that the physical resurrection of Jesus is pivotal or fundamental to the Christian faith is a gross understatement. It is the Christian faith. And so before we get started on why Christians believe in the resurrection of Jesus, I want to say three quick things. First off, I want to clarify that believing in an actual resurrection from the dead is not normal. You should be skeptical of hearing about someone coming back to life after dying and being buried. It's just not normal. So if you haven't given much or any thought to Jesus' claim of coming back to life and you feel skeptical, that's good. You should be. We should be. I should be. We all should be. That's normal. Christians should be very skeptical people because they believe some pretty outrageous things. But with that said, I, along with millions of others then and now, believe in the resurrection. Because of the evidence surrounding the event, the resurrection of Jesus remains the most plausible explanation of the circumstances. Okay? So that's the first thing. If you feel skeptical, that's good. Two, I just want to say that this is an introductory look into the apologetics of the resurrection. There are many scholarly works on the subject, past and present. William Lane Craig, J.P. Moreland, N.T. Wright, Josh McDowell, many, many people, noted scholars, have written books on this, and they will be mentioned in the notes and references below. But this is just a brief primer to the resurrection of Jesus. So if you come away thinking, oh, that was shallow, well, it is shallow. We're just touching the very basics of it. Thirdly, I just want to say too, where I got most of my notes for this podcast was based off of an article by John Piper. I'll put that in the notes as well. He does a good job of summarizing and encapsulating much of the larger work out there that's available. And he boils it down into three major truths, which I'm doing the same thing. So a lot of my notes are taken straight from John Piper's article, which is Historical Evidence for the Resurrection. With that said, let's start on the three major truths. Number one, the first truth is that the tomb of Jesus was empty. Okay? The tomb of Jesus was empty. We'll look at that through three different lenses almost, through the place, the people, and the time of the tomb. But the first truth is that the tomb of Jesus was empty. The second truth is that the lives of Jesus' disciples were radically changed after the resurrection. That's the second truth. The third truth is that the church began and grew with the resurrection of Jesus as its central message. But those are the three major truths, and we'll start now with the first major truth, which is the tomb of Jesus was empty. And when we say that the tomb of Jesus was empty, we're going to look at that through a couple different viewpoints. The first viewpoint is that we're going to consider the place of the resurrection. You think, what about the place of the resurrection? Well, Jesus' death and burial all happened in the city of Jerusalem. So did his resurrection. And the resurrection of Jesus was preached in the very city that he had been crucified and buried. That's important. The disciples didn't go to some obscure town to begin preaching about the resurrection. They began their preaching in Jerusalem, the very city where everyone had seen Jesus beaten and paraded through as a criminal just shortly before. If everyone in the city knew that Jesus was dead and buried, the disciples could have never had an audience for any amount of time. They just couldn't have. A German theologian, Paul Athanas, wrote that the proclamation of the resurrection, quote, could not have been maintained in Jerusalem for a single day, for a single hour, if the emptiness of the tomb had not been established as a fact for all concerned, end quote. So that's something that needs to be highlighted. And it might come across as common sense, but really, if the apostles, if the message of the resurrection was all a farce and if something that the apostles made up, as some have believed, then they would have gone to some no-name town with some no-name people and started this false belief. But they didn't. They started preaching the resurrection of Jesus in the very town to the very same people who saw Jesus paraded through the street, who saw Jesus hang on the cross, and who saw Jesus as a dead body enter into a tomb. This is the people who they started preaching the message of the resurrection. And it has to be noted. Secondly, Jesus' tomb was never venerated as a shrine. And at the time, it was custom to set up a sort of holy memorial at the site of a prophet or a holy man's bones. And supposedly, there were an estimated 50 sites in Jesus' day. But since there was no shrine for Jesus, it gives further evidence that his body did not remain entombed. So, as we've considered the empty tomb, we've considered the place of the resurrection, Jerusalem, and the site of the tomb, which was never made into a shrine. And now we want to consider the people associated with the resurrection. And this leads us to the next point, which is that all the Jewish people believed that the tomb was empty. We read this account in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 28. It says this, while the women were on their way, and we'll talk about the women in a little bit, but while the women were on their way, Some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priest everything that had happened. So as we've considered the empty tomb so far, we've considered the place of the resurrection, Jerusalem, and we've considered the site of the tomb, which was never made into a shrine. And now we want to consider the people associated with the resurrection. And this leads us to the next point, which is the Jewish people all believed that the tomb was empty. We find this account in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 28. And Jesus had an angel appeared at Jesus' tomb and said to the women who were there, he's not here anymore. The women go on their way, and on their way, Jesus himself appears to them. And so this is kind of where the story picks up. Chapter 28, verse 11, it says, while the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city, because guards were watching the tomb when the angel came and rolled away the stone and showed that the tomb was empty. But it says, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priest, those are the Jewish chief priest, everything that had happened. So we have Roman soldiers reporting to the Jewish chief priest everything that had happened. And when the chief priest had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, quote, you are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. Because there would have been a lot of trouble if guards fell asleep on the watch. They most likely would have been put to death. So that he said, the elder said, tell him this story and we'll keep you out of trouble. Verse 15, so the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. The point of that passage is just to acknowledge that the tomb was empty. There's no argument as to whether it was or whether it was not. There is one story that the angel rolled away the stone, and the tomb was empty, and Jesus appeared later to the women. And the other story is that the disciples came at nighttime and stole the body away. But both stories agree that no body was in the tomb. And so that's obviously from the Gospel of Matthew, but there's other non-Christian sources confirming that same story, that everyone agreed that the tomb was empty. How it was empty is up to debate, but the tomb was empty. We see this from Josephus. He was a Roman Jewish historian who lived from 37 to 100 AD. He writes as much. There's another Roman historian, Tacitus, who wrote the similar story, and he lived in 64 AD. He was a contemporary of Josephus. There's also a compilation of early Jewish writings, and it also acknowledges that the tomb was empty, and it attempts to explain it away. But the point is that it all these non-Christian sources acknowledge that the tomb was indeed empty. So it's a pretty well-established belief that the early Jews, both those who claimed that Jesus resurrected and those who claimed that his body was stolen, both friends and foes of Jesus, all agree that the tomb was indeed empty. So now we'll continue to look at the people involved in the resurrection. And we'll turn our attention to the women of the New Testament. And the New Testament records that the empty tomb was first discovered by women, and that Jesus himself revealed his resurrected body to women before he did any of his male followers. And you might say, well, that who cares? But again, this is extremely important, because in the time and culture of the first century, the testimony of women was basically considered worthless. their opinion, their side of the story was, again, basically considered worthless. So apologist William Craig Lane says this. He summarizes it nicely. He says, if the empty tomb story were a legend, then it is most likely that the male disciples would have been made the first to discover the empty tomb. The fact that despised women, whose testimony was deemed worthless, were the chief witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb can only be plausibly explained if, like it or not, they actually were the discoverers of the empty tomb. And what he's basically saying is that if the story of the resurrection was a farce, if it was something that the apostles made up, the disciples made up, Christians made up, then no one would have had recorded in the Gospels that women were the ones who discovered the empty tomb, and that Jesus appeared first to women before he did his male disciples. It wouldn't have been written that way, but that's what the Gospels tell us. And so, again, it's really important to know that Jesus revealed himself to women first. If it hadn't been true, he wouldn't have done that. The story wouldn't have gone that way, but the story is that way, and it gives us much more confidence in the validity of the resurrection of Jesus. So far we've considered the empty tomb. We've looked at the place of the resurrection and the people involved in the resurrection, and now we'll look at the time of the resurrection. It's important to note that when we examine the time of the resurrection in relation to the text that document it, we need to know how close they are in years. The death and resurrection of Jesus was 30 to 33 AD, and nearly all of the New Testament was written within 15 to 30 years of that time. And this is far too close to the event to have become legend. And most legends are usually built through a time span of 100 or hundreds of years. The word legend is defined as a traditional story, sometimes popularly regarded as historical, but unauthenticated. Synonyms of legend are myth, folklore, fantasy, fairy tale, mythology, things that are more fanciful than they are factual. So the more years between an event and its documentation, the more difficult it is to verify. But with the resurrection of Jesus, there is a very short time between the time that it happened and the time that it was recorded. The Gospel of Mark is thought to be the earliest of the four Gospels and is believed to have been based upon a source that originated within 7 years of the resurrection. Rudolf Pesch is a German commentator. He points this out by noting that the pre-Markan source, the source that Mark drew upon to write his gospel, never mentions the high priest by name. Michael Horton summarizes this by saying, quote, if it had been written after Caiaphas's term of office, his name would have had to have been used to distinguish him from the next high priest. But since Caiaphas was high priest from AD 18 to 37, this story began circulating no later than AD 37, within the first 7 years after the events. So again, it's important to know this and to appreciate this, because there are theories that the resurrection of Jesus really is just a legend. It's a myth that the church made up hundreds of years after Jesus existed to give claim to the divinity of Jesus, and it was something that they pretty much fabricated. And the evidence that we just went through today dismantles that. So To summarize our first 3 points of our first truth, the first truth is this, that the tomb was empty. We looked at the place. It was preached in Jerusalem, and Jesus' tomb was never venerated as a shrine. We looked at the people. The Jews, both friends and foes of Jesus, believed that the tomb was empty. Furthermore, the tomb was discovered by women. And lastly, we looked at the time, the early documentation of the resurrection. All of these point to the validity that Jesus resurrected, which is what he claimed he would do. He predicted that. And we can look at that later. But we move on to our second point now, or our second truth. The second truth that points to the resurrection of Jesus is that the lives of Jesus' disciples were radically changed afterwards. We know that the lives of Jesus' disciples were radically changed afterwards because they had real experiences with a resurrected Jesus, beginning on the Sunday that he rose from the dead. We read in Acts chapter 1, verse 3, that Jesus showed himself alive by many infallible proofs. And then over a period of 40 days, he periodically instructed his apostles and his disciples. And then he ascended from Mount Olivet near Jerusalem while the apostles watched. This is in Acts chapter 1, verses 9 through 12. Paul, the apostle, would later write in 1 Corinthians, his letter to the church in Corinth. He said that Jesus revealed himself to over 500 people at once. And he said, most of these people who saw this, who saw the resurrected Jesus, are still alive. Some have died since then, but most of them are still alive. So we know that the disciples had experiences with Jesus after he died and resurrected. And because of this, this radically changed their lives. And as you read through the Gospels, it paints a picture of who the disciples were. And the gospel accounts show the 12 followers of Jesus as being authentically human. They were full of pride. They would get in arguments with each other. They wanted to be the next in line. They wanted to be the most powerful. They were full of failures. They were full of fear. So much so that at the point when Jesus needed their company the most, they nearly all abandon him for their own self-preservation. So again, before the resurrection, the disciples, they vied for power. They were fearful. They fled the garden. Peter denied Jesus 3 times, and everyone but John were not there at the crucifixion. But after the resurrection, directly after the resurrection, Acts chapter 4, we see the lives of the disciples, now apostles, in a completely new light. And there is this awesome account of this in the book of Acts. And so the real quick context is this, that Peter and John healed this crippled guy, and the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leaders at the time, were very upset because they thought they had squashed out Jesus. They thought he was dead. He was gone. And yet here are his disciples claiming that he's alive and still doing miracles in Jesus' name. And the Sanhedrin just doesn't know how to respond. So they say, you cannot teach or preach about Jesus anymore. But here's the verse I want to look at in Acts chapter 4, verse 13. When they, the Sanhedrin, the most powerful Supreme Court of the time, all Jewish leaders, when they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized that they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished, and they took note that these men had been with Jesus. Now, I could preach a whole message just on that verse alone, but suffice to say that the Sanhedrin looked at these men. They saw that they were not smart. They were unschooled. They didn't go to seminary. They were ordinary men, and they were astonished because of their courage and their boldness. And they said, these men have been with Jesus. So suffice to say that these men who were once fearful and cared for their own lives, who cared for their own popularity and social standing, who, just like me and you, they wanted to live comfortable lives, they're throwing all of those cares away now for what they had seen and heard in the resurrection of Jesus. They were willing to suffer for their faith. The Apostle Paul personally recounted the suffering that he endured, which included being whipped, beaten, stoned, shipwrecked, nearly starved to death. He was in danger from various people and places all the time. He said this in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And then, speaking for the apostles, after being threatened by the Sanhedrin, Peter and John say, quote, "For we cannot but speak of what we have seen and heard," end quote, Acts chapter 4:20. The apostles were then thrown into prison, beaten for their faith, but they continued to preach and teach the gospel of Jesus. And because they continued to do this, it not only led to their persecution, but it eventually led to their martyrdom. And most of the disciples we know were martyred for their faith. And so, to recap, the second truth that points to the resurrection of Jesus is that the lives of his disciples were radically changed afterwards. His resurrection had transformed them. People do not suffer, nor are they martyred, for what they know is a lie. And because of this, we again have powerful evidence that Jesus indeed resurrected. And this leads into our third and last truth, which is that the church began and grew with the resurrection of Jesus as its central message. Again, the third truth is that the church began and grew in hostile territory with no political support. In fact, the church was politically suppressed and popularly condemned for hundreds of years. Yet in these circumstances, the church upheld the resurrection of Jesus as its central message. And the church had such a vast and, quite frankly, a supernatural impact upon the world on all levels that the Emperor of Rome, Constantine, declared Christianity as the state religion in 313 AD. This was called the Edict of Milan. And as we consider the history of the church and the place that the resurrection of Jesus takes in it, we also need to ponder the personal testimony of Christians today. Many, many people all across the world have encountered Jesus, where just as the apostles had changed lives, they do too. I am one of them. Personal stories, or what we call, Christians call, testimonies, can be real evidence of real people having been changed by a real and living Jesus. To briefly recap for the evidence and reason of the resurrection of Jesus: 1, the tomb of Jesus was empty. 2, the lives of Jesus' disciples were radically changed after his resurrection. And 3, the church began and grew with the resurrection of Jesus as its central message. Thanks again for listening. Next week, we'll discuss how to apply the death and resurrection of Jesus to our lives. Because you might be asking yourself, who cares? Who cares if Jesus lived, if he died, and if he even resurrected? Who cares? If it means nothing, then who cares? And definitely, why should I care? In the next podcast, the fourth of five episodes in our series of Foundational Faith, the historical Jesus now becomes a personal Jesus when we apply the gospel to our lives. We'll see how this is a completely unique message of Christianity that stands alone in world religions. I'll give you a hint with two words: faith and grace.